Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's time! With Bruce Buffer. And now, it's time for the voice of mixed martial arts.
We are live!
It's Bruce Buffer.
Bruce Buffer.
From the shores of Malibu where the waves are pumping, to the Great Wall of China and back to the streets of Los Angeles, California, where the UFC is coming. We are live. This is It's Time Radio, the show where we talk about what you think about but may be afraid to voice. Do not worry, we will voice it for you because we talk about everything on It's Time. It's No Holds Barred Radio, folks, and that's the kind of show we have today. We've got to talk about UFCs, we got to talk about current events, and we have a very special guest that I want to bring on now to set the pace for the rest of the show. Let's bring on my friend, the great commentator from the UFC, Mr. John Anik. John, how are you?
I am doing well. You know, the dulcet tones of TJ DeSantis and Bruce Buffer have put me in a good place here during fight week. So
I like it very much. And, you know, to let everybody in on a little bit of trivia here, not trivia, a little scuttlebutt, shall we say, John and I were in Calgary, TJ, and we flew back early on Sunday together because, of course, this is LA fight week. John's got a lot to do. As a matter of fact, today he's taking, what are you doing today, John? You're taking interviews with fighters?
So Tuesday we do the fighter calls. For a pay-per-view like this, Thursday is reserved for the fighter meeting. So most of the pay-per-view fighters and the higher profile fighters will sit down with on Thursday. But now we do these fighter calls on Tuesday. They check in, they sign a poster, they call me, we talk for 3 or 5 minutes. And that's sort of the route around which all of my other prep sort of falls. And hopefully we won't have to bail for a fighter call, but you can be sure, Buff, with all due respect, that if Brett Johns is beeping in, man, I'm going to have to let you fly.
Hey, listen, I thoroughly understand. It's called, I got somebody more important on the other line, and I won't take offense to it. So don't worry about that. Hey, so TJ, we came back early, right? Now, John and I are good friends. So we actually, John has been staying at Buffer Manor for the last couple days, and he left this morning to get to his hotel for all the work he does. I mean, this man only doesn't stop talking for 7-8 hours on a night of UFC, you know, event on a show. But there's a tremendous amount of preparation work that he goes through. And yesterday, I had the pleasure of being on your set. I went over and filmed your podcast with Kenny Florian yesterday. What an elaborate set. He's a busy man this week.
Yeah, it's always busy, man. And the back-to-backs are a little bit challenging. And I'm sure if there's an NFL play-by-play guy listening to this, he might be rolling his eyes because he does 17 straight Sundays. But as TJ can attest, as you can certainly attest, Buff, mixed martial arts is a different beast. You know, I got 26 fighters to learn, and coming off a show in which I had 26 other fighters to learn, you're talking about 52 fighters in a span of 10 or 11 days. So the prep's a little bit condensed with the back-to-backs, but thankfully I was able to get out to LA early and make good use of the extra time here at the BMM Fight Week.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last 2 days has been brotherly fun in the sun. We had a really good time, some good meals, but you know what, for you and for me, it's back to work. So speaking about back to work, we were in Calgary last Saturday. One hell of a show, no question. The crowd, the fans there made noise as loud as they do or have never done or will do again. In Canada, it's amazing how rabid fans they are, and I love it. I know you love it, John, but the fights were off the hook. And what can you say? Jose Aldo is back. Dustin Poirier is on his way to his next step to where he's going in his career. Joanna's back in respect to the fact she came off with a win. Hell of a night, wasn't it, John?
Well, it's great. And I think it's what makes this sport great is that you have one singular Fox UFC fight night and so many different storylines come out of it. And as far as your point off the top about these Canadian crowds, it sounds like I'm banging on the Americans all the time, but when we go to Brazil, when we go to Australia, when we go to England, or we go to Ireland, or certainly Canada, the crowds are a big part of our success. As announcers, we really feed off of that. And I think too often when we hit your average domestic market, the UFC doesn't necessarily have the same appeal as it does internationally. So it certainly was a huge treat for me to be in Calgary for the first time, beautiful city, and a lot of different things come out of it. But for me, the big storyline is Dustin Poirier and what this man has accomplished. When you start to look at the body of work on paper, 16 UFC wins, despite the fact that he only made his UFC debut in 2011. He's already four off the all-time record, a finisher of the highest order. 11 of his UFC wins have come by stoppage, either knockout or submission. And I just feel like he's underappreciated for the body of work that he's put together. And who would have thought that after that loss to Conor McGregor in 2014, that Dustin would ever work himself within striking distance of another shot at Conor McGregor in any division. And right now, it goes without saying, Dustin Poirier is on the short list of lightweight contenders, and deservedly so.
Absolutely. And his future is bright. He's got some very tough opponents. I mean, is it Tony Ferguson? Of course, the winner of Habib and Conor, with that fight yet to be made, but we all know hopefully it will be. A very, very strong set of people he's got to come up against. There's no question. Jose Aldo, who's been in this game absolutely forever, coming off a win, the liver shot Saturday night, the kicks earlier to the left hand to the liver of Jeremy Stephens by Jose Aldo. Just beautiful striking at its best. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I think for a lot of us who have admired Jose Aldo for some time, we got a little bit emotional, too, that he sort of realized this breakthrough moment. And someone might say, oh, breakthrough moment, this is the consensus greatest featherweight of all time. But you got to recognize where he was in his career. The Conor McGregor setback, the Max Holloway series didn't go his way. And even though there was a Frankie Edgar win mixed in there, Jose Aldo hadn't put anybody away since 2013. And I think he was sort of waiting to exhale for a lot of different reasons. And I think he proved a lot to himself this night as to what he might have left. And even though I think a lot of fans don't love him in another matchup with Max Holloway, or they don't like him against Brian T. City Ortega, you know, Jeremy Stephens was on an absolute tear, and Jose Aldo muted that noise and then some. He had to put himself in harm's way. He did eat an uppercut and a couple other big shots. And this was a fight that could have gone either way. And obviously, if Jeremy Stephens had connected a little bit more flush, the narrative here on Tuesday is a lot different. But I feel really good for Jose Aldo. And I think when you look back at his legacy, because there haven't been that many stoppage wins in the UFC, this is just his third finish in the UFC, this is going to go down, even though not of the championship variety, as one of the biggest wins of Jose Aldo's career. And I just think it was a special night for him. And thankfully, he had an adoring crowd that could enjoy that moment with him. Huge night for Jose Aldo, and it's going to be interesting to see how the promotion spins it forward. I'm not sure it's going to be a title fight next, but if Max Holloway isn't good to go by the end of the year, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see them make a fight between Jose Aldo and Brian T. City Ortega.
Well, welcome to the world of MMA, and he's back in the mix, and we'll see where that mix takes him. Joanna Jędrzejczyk, were you impressed with her performance against Tisha Torres?
I was, because I think for Tisha Torres, she knew she was going to have to take Joanna Jędrzejczyk down at least once to win the fight. I don't think she had any opinion that she was going to be able to win a stand-up fight or a kickboxing match for 15 minutes with Joanna Jędrzejczyk. So I thought that the wrestling and the grappling of Jędrzejczyk was a big takeaway for me. Her work in the clinch, her deceptive strength. People don't give Jędrzejczyk enough credit for her takedown defense or her strength. You know, this is a woman who outpointed one Jessica Andrade over 25 minutes. And most people believe the former bantamweight Andrade, now a strawweight, is the toughest matchup for them in this division. A two woman in that top 10, they think Andrade is the toughest fight. And Jędrzejczyk obviously passed that test, passed this Tisha Torres test. I would like to see Joanna move up to flyweight at some point in time. I'm not sure a trilogy fight with Nama Yunus has legs because of the way the first two fights went. But Joanna seems hell-bent on hanging out at 115 and getting her belt back before she moves up. So this performance was certainly a step in the right direction. And I think for Tisha Torres, she's sort of hard to pin down for me. You know, she does give up some size. And even though maybe at 5'1", she has used that lack of height as an advantage in some fights, you know, I thought this fight was eye-opening. The fact that she was unable to take Joanna Jędrzejczyk down, and because she doesn't have a lot of finishing ability on the feet, you know, there weren't that many paths to victory for Tisha. So I sort of feel like it's going to be a long uphill climb for Tisha to get back into contention. But for Joanna, she has set herself up for another big fight. And given her profile, Buff, and given the way you saw this Canadian crowd react to her, I can only think the promotion would be motivated to put her in some sort of championship setting, even if that means an Amy Yunus fight, or if it means taking on the winner of Nico Montano and Valentina Shevchenko. I think Yan Jacek is a great five-round fighter. I think the UFC knows what they have in her. And in one division or another, I wouldn't be surprised if her next fight was for a title.
I fully agree with you, and I can understand her reasoning and her want to dominate the strawweight division. But let's face it, going up to flyweight, I agree with you. She can fight at that weight. She has fought at that weight. She'll be dominating at that weight. But she's obviously set a goal for herself. She wants her belt back, and that's her goal. And we'll see how it progresses. Now, with that be happening down in Calgary last Saturday, we've got a big show coming here in LA this weekend. That's why we're all here. And the two main key fights on this card are the flyweight title between Henry Cejudo and Demetrius Johnson, the second time they faced off against each other. We've got the bantamweight title we're all looking forward to seeing, as we're looking forward to seeing all these fights against Cody Garbrandt and TJ Dillashaw. Let's start with the Cejudo fight and Demetrius Johnson. Demetrius Johnson, by most people's opinions, is pound for pound the greatest MMA fighter of currently, if not of all time. That is a popular consensus out there. Am I incorrect in that, guys?
No, I mean, I think skill for skill, I'm sure TJ would agree. Most people believe that Demetrius Johnson is the guy. People are going to denigrate his strength of schedule until the end of time. And certainly it hasn't been a murderer's row of flyweight contenders. But it's 11 consecutive UFC title defenses. I mean, what else are you looking for? He's about to defend the belt, or try to, for a 12th consecutive time. I don't care who you are in any division, that's a record that is not going to be broken. And when I said that a couple years ago, people were like, oh, you know, Joanna's coming, and Max Holloway has won 12 or 13 straight fights. He's defended the undisputed title one time, okay? So he's got a long way to go. He's probably going to move up to lightweight before he gets even close to DJ's record. I think the interesting storyline for me in this one is the less known quantity, and that's Henry Cejudo, because when these two guys fought in April of 2016, Cejudo was still a developing fighter. And you can argue he's still a developing mixed martial art athlete, but his striking, Cejudo's, is on a completely different level than it was when these guys met in April of 2016. I'm not saying it's going to be enough to beat DJ necessarily, but if you talk to Cejudo and his camp, you know, that first meeting was over before it started. Henry has totally different striking coaches and minds in his ear than he did back then. So I expected the betting odds to be wide, but I think it's going to be a more competitive fight, certainly, than the first one. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Cejudo give DJ his toughest title defense since Timothy Elliott a few years ago. So I'm excited to see a competitive fight. And Cejudo has a lot of Daniel Cormier qualities, just in terms of his competitive nature. And his ability to rise to the proverbial occasion. So I think there are a lot of competitive things and juices that I like about Henry Cejudo, and maybe that's why I give him more of a chance than most.
I don't want to sound like a broken record here real quick, Bruce, but I echo all of John's statements. And if you want to talk about strength of schedule with Demetrius Johnson, arguing point against that would be, if you throw another human being up in the air and put him in an arm bar before he hits the ground, you're the baddest man on the planet. I don't care.
I have to agree with that. We've all seen that happen. He's amazing. You know, Cejudo, he was stopped by Demetrius Johnson and, you know, via strikes, basically at 2 minutes and 49 seconds of the first round of their flyweight title fight back at UFC 197. So being the Olympic wrestling athlete that he is, and like John said, there are similarities between him and DC Cormier, we're talking about a very, very competitive individual at the highest level that is coming back for revenge and also coming back to win the title. That's a lot in somebody's mind.
And for my money too, again, echoing what John was saying, like, I know this is a sequel to their first fight, but for all intents and purposes, Henry Cejudo is so almost re-engineered to a point coming into this bout that it's not fair to even really take anything from that first meeting and apply it to breaking down this fight. I think Henry's going to bring a lot of different looks than he had, you know, in that first fight. He really didn't get, you know, his cylinder's really firing at all. This fight is going to be a tough one, I think. I think, if I had to make a pick, I probably lean towards Demetrius Johnson. How do you pick against the man? But Henry Cejudo is going to make this one a fight.
John, you're big on the odds. You know the odds. I mean, obviously, the earlier fight between Cub Swanson and Hanato Moicano, the Cub is like a 4-1 underdog. What are the odds on the Henry Cejudo fight with Demetrius Johnson?
They're almost identical. Renato Moicano and Demetrius Johnson are both in that minus 450, minus 475 range. And Henry Cejudo and Cub Swanson coming back about plus 325, plus 350. And we've talked about it on It's Time. We've talked about it on the Anakin Florian podcast. You're not betting the fighter. You're betting the number, right? So
right.
I can sit here and say Renato Moicano is a real problem. And Vegas knows. And I can understand why Moicano's favored in the fight, but it looks a little bloated to me, and I can understand why a lot of the betting public would see value on the more public name, Cub Swanson, getting plus 325, plus 350.
Did we lose John?
Whoa.
If you're very convicted, are you there?
Yeah, John, you kind of sounded like you were from Mars for a second, but we got you back.
Yeah, I heard that. So if you're very convicted on one side of the Dillashaw-Garbrandt fight, then go ahead and play it. But I find it hard to believe that anybody can look at that matchup and say they feel confidently that if these guys met 10 times, one guy's going to win 8 or 9 of them. I think the fight is that close. So that fight to me screams layoff. You know, certainly wouldn't touch my money on that fight. Maybe you can look at a prop that it goes under 4.5 rounds or something like that. But you really have to get past the name and look at the number and try to find value. And that's really the best way to approach it. And by and large, I think with mixed martial arts, I know I'm giving you more than you asked for here, but focus on straight wagers. I think a lot of gamblers, when they're betting MMA, they put a parlay down on paper and it looks pretty appetizing because it pays 5 or 6 to 1. This sport is as unpredictable as any in the world. And trying to pick 3 or 4 fights correct on one night is a huge ask. So I would tell anybody who's listening, try to focus on straight wagers when you're betting MMA.
Well, the one key point of that is nobody knows more than you do when it comes to looking and analyzing the fights and who would win, or in your opinion, or who's worth putting a bet on in your opinion. Think about the people that don't have that knowledge. And here you are with all that knowledge, and it's hard to get the 100% mark. Like you said, it's very hard to pick all the fights right, because in our sport, as in any sport really, but especially in the octagon, anybody can win on any given day. May the best man or woman win at their best performance they're giving on that given night. It's really what it comes down to. So enjoy your bets, guys.
Yeah.
Enjoy them. Let's talk about the main event. Cody Garbrandt, TJ Dillashaw. Cody, no love Garbrandt with no love for TJ Dillashaw. This is definitely going to be all throw for the wall, bang down, knock down, drag out, 5 rounds or less fight. What are the odds on this one, John? Who are they calling in this one?
It's essentially a pick 'em. So TJ Dillashaw is a slight favorite online right now at minus 120. Cody is also in the minus at minus 110. And a lot of the sharp guys I've talked to this week are leaning towards Cody Garbrandt. They think he's the slightly better athlete in this equation, maybe has more natural power and more natural speed. You know, Ken Flo on our podcast pointed to the fight between Cody Garbrandt and Dominic Cruz and Cody's ability to stay patient and to beat Dom at his own game and to be very effective with his counter striking. You know, I think some patience would serve Cody Garbrandt well. And I think in an emotional grudge match rivalry type of fight like this, it's a lot easier said than done to check and bottle those emotions. But I do agree with a lot of the analysis out there that I think Cody Garbrandt is the better athlete. I do think he has more natural power, even though he doesn't have as many ways to beat you on the feet. And also, too, I think, you know, in Major League Baseball, you talk a lot about dinging and donging, right? If the Yankees win today, I'll play the Red Sox tomorrow. You know, I think these guys are destined for a trilogy. Dillashaw took the first meeting, so I wouldn't be at all surprised to see Cody even the score here and these guys fight for a third time. But I really think it's that close. You know, when I look at Daniel Cormier and Stipe Miocic, I think if those guys fought 10 times, DC wins 7 or 8 of them. I think if Cody and TJ fight 10 times, it's 5 apiece. So I think it's going to be a very close fight. You know, I do think we're going to get a finish this time around. I don't think it's going to be the full 25 minutes because both guys are just that spectacular on the feet. But it's going to be exciting as long as it lasts, man. And I'm excited for these guys to get the LA spotlight because these are two of the best we have in any division, and I think they certainly deserve it.
Well, you know, they definitely do go at it. I mean, Garbrandt won a 5-round unanimous decision over Dominic Cruz at UFC 207 to win the bantamweight title. And then he comes back, gets knocked out by TJ Dillashaw in their war, which ended, you know, 2 minutes and 40 seconds or so in the second round when he lost the title. So these two definitely go at it. It's going to be a heck of a night. a hell of a night, shall we say. And I'm really looking forward to that. Those three fights, there's another 12 fights on the card. I think we're 13 total for the evening. You've got a lot of work going on this week, John. I don't want to hold you up. I do want to bring one more story in that I don't know if we discussed this weekend, but you know, the CTE issues, the concussion issues in the NFL, the season's about to start. And the Seahawks, Joshua Perry, he just announced retirement after a sixth documented concussion at the age of 24 years old. So do you feel that...
All right, go ahead. Yeah, six documented. So
documented, exactly.
Beckons, how many concussions has he had that weren't documented dating to Pop Warner in middle school football? So I am always in favor of an athlete stepping away when there's some type of head condition or issue. And obviously, in the case of Perry, there have been multiple documented concussions. And it's hard to walk away at 24, you know, from guaranteed money and from getting close to an NFL pension and everything else that goes into it. But I wish more fighters would recognize that they're getting to a certain point. And even if, you know, a guy like Eddie Alvarez, for lack of a better example, even if he feels sharp as a tack and is as well-spoken and articulate as any fighter on the card, anyone who has watched MMA for the last decade knows that Eddie has sustained a lot of concussive damage, that Eddie Alvarez has an ability to rally through adversity and win MMA fights unlike any athlete I've ever seen. But what is the cost? He has four children. He absorbed a whole lot of concussive damage once again this weekend, and Eddie Alvarez ain't hanging him up, you know, and I just think two or three more fights down the line could put him in a place that isn't so good. I'm not sitting here saying he has CTE, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. So I think that anytime we see a story of an athlete retiring prematurely because of head issues, I think that athlete is to be supported. And hopefully for Perry, he can land softly on TV, which I know is his aspiration, because he's preserving his brain, and I give him a lot of respect for doing that.
Well, good. I wish him all the best, too. And I'm, again, TJ and I are in full agreement with everything you're saying today, John. It's exactly true. And
well,
it's
and TJ has watched Eddie Alvarez in his entire career. You know, I called an Eddie Alvarez fight back in 2009. And if you would have told me then that 10 years later, he'd still be competing with and beating the best lightweights in the world, I would say, physically, how can he? But I think he's been smart at times about body preservation and training and understanding the benefits of sparring and not sparring so much. But I don't know, man, it's just sometimes hard when you see an athlete like Darren Elkins survive, and their toughness ends up being something that they are revered for, and yet it's something that could really cause them problems down the line. It is a really difficult situation. I'm not saying there's an easy solution, but I think it's an important thing to be brought up, and I'm glad that, you know, we discussed it a little bit today.
Yeah, I'm glad too. I'm all about safety for the fighters. I'm all about their living the future lives they have to the end as healthy and mentally fit and physically fit as possible. And I want Eddie to be able to watch his beloved Philadelphia Eagles win the Super Bowl come the next season, which is about to start. And I read where he just spent $142,000 on a special tailgate van that looks amazing, because he is a huge tailgater. He loves the whole tailgating process, and like where TJ comes from, Minneapolis, and like Wisconsin, and pretty much like anywhere when the NFL plays, those tailgate parties, if you're a tailgater, that's a big deal. That's almost as important as the game that's about to play.
Dude, go to some of those tailgate parties and just forget going to the game. Most of those tailgate buses have, like, DirecTV inside of it. So, you know, stay in there, especially if it's an outdoor stadium. Get hooked up with a buddy, sit in their luxury suite out in the parking lot, and pregame and postgame.
Hey, considering what they're drinking and doing out at that tailgate party, they might forget to go to the game by the time the game starts. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tailgated at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts for almost every home game from 2000 to 2006. And a quick story on the way out, actually. The first year the Patriots won the Super Bowl, they had a regular season Sunday night game against the St. Louis Rams. And it ended up being foreboding a little bit because they would play the Rams in the Super Bowl, and they lost this game, but it was the last game they lost, I believe. Well, I hit the tailgate a little bit too hard. So I was running to my seat, running up the cement stairs at Gillette Stadium right before kickoff. I had a beer in one hand, an Italian sausage in the other. I slipped on the concrete stair, fell flat on my face. I looked down and my pinky nail was completely gone.
Oh, that's not fun.
So So, you know, obviously some of the alcohol in my system numbed the pain a little bit, but I had to watch a 3-hour football game there in the cold with 9 fingernails. The thing was completely flush off, bleeding all over the place, all over the sausage roll. It was a fucking mess. So I had tempered my tailgates ever since that baseball match.
I'd say that'd be a pretty good time to really think about tempering it up. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Who wants to go through that again? John, I know you're busy. I'm going to see you on Saturday, if not Friday. Thanks for coming over. Thanks for hanging out for a couple days. We had a great time. And let's get back to work, bro, because that's what we do. We're UFC people, and that's what we're going to do this weekend.
That is what we do. Well, thanks for the hospitality, buddy, and it's always good to be on with you fellas.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on your podcast yesterday.
Anytime. Pleasure, boys. Talk to you soon.
See you, John.
Right,
take care, John.
See you, Teach.
All right, before we get to all the other current events that you want to talk about, Buff, I want to hit you up on one topic. Maybe you don't have an opinion, but it's definitely, to me, a sort of an elephant in the room when we talk about Dustin Poirier and Eddie Alvarez, and that is the 12-6 elbow that caused referee Mark Goddard to stand Eddie up, which ultimately led to his demise. He was in a fantastic position, fully mounted on Poirier. He throws this downward elbow, and that caused the referee to stand them up, and we all know what happened shortly thereafter. You ever heard that old saying, Bruce, that it's impossible to draw a perfect circle? Like, a human being can't draw a perfect circle?
Yeah, of course I have.
You also can't throw a perfect 12-6 elbow, and these are the words essentially from one Big John McCarthy. And I don't know how he feels about this situation, but in the past, John has talked about the 12-6 elbow. And we know that the rule in mixed martial arts, for the most part, the 12-6 elbow comes from misinformation. The idea that you can destroy someone's skull with a 12-6 elbow, because we saw it on ESPN back in the day with martial artists destroying cement bricks and all that fun stuff. I don't believe that you can ever really truly be in a position to throw a 12-6 elbow. For the most part, they're ineffective. Poirier even said as such in his post-fight interview. I think it was a shame that Goddard called it. I don't think that it was a 12-6 elbow. Everything has an arc to it. You can't go straight from the ceiling to the floor, especially in that position. If you look at the replay, there is an arcing motion to it, but that's neither here nor there. Goddard did what he thought to do best and follow protocol. But this rule needs to go away, Bruce, because it dramatically affected the outcome of this Alvarez and Poirier fight. And, it's really sort of a nonsense sort of rule to have this big of a impact and this big of a fight.
Yeah, and I know there was controversy, if that's what you want to call it, the fans watching and everybody else. Mark Goddard went public with his response to the heat that came through. When I was on Kenny's and John's podcast yesterday, they pretty much, if I remember correctly, backed up Goddard's decision and what he did. This is the type of thing where you really get down to the fact, and yes, you can't, draw the perfect circle, or however that term goes.
Right.
But it's all about the referee's perception, which is the right reality of the fight at that time. And right, no matter what it's like a judge at the end. When I get those judges' rules and it's split decision, 29-28, right, 29-28 for the winner and 30-27 for the loser.
Right. Yeah.
You ask yourself, what the hell are they looking at?
Right.
If that's the differential.
And let me clear something up too, because I'm echoing again the sentiments of both John and Kenny. I don't think that Mark Goddard necessarily did anything wrong.
I don't either.
I think he could have ignored it had he wanted to, or just shouted out a warning to Eddie. But the bottom line is, it is a foul. The definition of whether or not you take a point away or break, the action due to an illegal blow is whether or not it was intentional and whether or not it had a lasting effect on the fight. While I don't think it had a lasting effect on the fight, I mean, it was intentional. Eddie Alvarez didn't throw accidental elbows, you know what I mean? And Goddard, even in his interaction with Eddie in the neutral corner, was, hey, it's not my rule. And I thought that was his sort of way of saying, look, I'm here to enforce the rules. I don't make the rules. I may not even necessarily agree with this rule. And I thought Goddard did a fine job doing what he did, but the bottom line is, it directly impacted the fight. And then there were also some other things that happened that I thought were more egregious, more blatant in the fight, that weren't necessarily called. One, Eddie Alvarez was holding onto the fence when he was in a guillotine. what do you do there? It's really hard to chastise Eddie, who's caught in a submission. What are you going to do, take away the submission from Poirier to tell Eddie he can't grab the fence? Hard to really make a decision there. But in the flurry that ended the fight, Poirier grabs the fence and throws a high kick. That is more blatant, more egregious, and you could argue maybe more impactful of a foul than what Eddie did. But, you know, the referee, hardest job, I think, in the business. And, you know, we really rarely ever call anybody out that's an official when they do a fantastic job. And more often than not, I think Mark Otter does a fantastic job. And again, I think I'm almost arguing against my own point here. I don't think he necessarily did anything wrong. It was just highly unfortunate.
Yeah, that I can't say it any different. And, you know, speaking for the referees, there are great referees. There are solid referees. And we've certainly seen some poor referees.
Oh, yeah. You're putting it kindly.
I'm putting it kindly. Now, the top referees in the business, now that John McCarthy is with Bellator,
right.
I don't think he's refereeing, or maybe he is, but he's not refereeing in any events that I've been announcing.
I don't believe he's refereeing.
I don't think he's refereeing, and probably I hope he doesn't have to because he has such a great position with Bellator and everything else he's doing.
Right.
Mark Goddard is one of the top referees. Mark Goddard's also very similar in the way he referees, in my opinion, to the way John McCarthy referees.
I agree. There's a reason Goddard's being flown all over the place when he's not a native to the jurisdiction. You know what I mean?
Exactly, because he's one of the best. Herb Dean, most definitely the top, one of the best. And I'm going to tell you another referee that I think is one of the best. And there's a number I could name. But for expediency's sake, I want to give this man his credit. He works Saturday night, and his name is Keith Peterson. I think Keith Peterson is one of the best referees in the business.
No, he's great. Person. He's great. I mean, my favorite referees, McCarthy, Dean. I like Keith Peterson a lot. Jason Herzog, I think, is incredibly overlooked. He's a fantastic referee.
Excellent referee.
Yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on. And I won't name the names of people that I think should be fired in every jurisdiction.
No,
because that's bad. But, you know, the bottom line is I think that, you know, Mark Ratner, who has a lot of say in, you know, what referees hit the road with the UFC and get licensed in the jurisdiction that the Octagon is setting up in, he's done a fairly good job in recognizing the talent that the referees have, and those officials are rewarded with, you know, road assignments, if you will.
Exactly. Now, you know, we're coming to California this week, and you might be wondering who's going to be refereeing California. And I'm very happy to say, you know, if you want to have an idea here, Herb Dean, of course, is going to be there.
Right.
Mike Beltran, who does a hell of a job.
Fantastic referee.
Fantastic referee. And Frank Trigg. Frank Trigg.
Oh, Trigg, yeah. I mean, a lot of people have thought, you know, when are referees going to be made of old fighters and old judges old fighters and judges be made up of old fighters as well? You know, Trigg, if you're listening, I'm not calling you old, sir. All right. You still look great. Young buck, if you will. But, you know, Trigg is a guy that has some of the best experience under his belt as a competitor. And, you know, he's putting in the rounds as a referee and official as well.
Treat Trigg nice. You don't want to run into him in an elevator down at the LA Sheraton.
Unless I got you with me. Unless you're with me, then I'm okay.
Trigg and I are buddies. You know that. Okay, we're all good.
Oh, okay. Lord. Someone's like, what does this mean? Let me go down this rabbit hole. Google it, people. You'll be fine.
Means nothing. It means Frank Trigg's going to be refereeing, and that's where we're at right now. Let's go on to the news. The car fire in California. This has now become considered by the statistics the seventh worst fire in the history of California. And it's already killed 8 people. The heat spells are just beyond bearable.
Right.
The destruction is that of like the aftermath of an atomic bomb. This is not even my quote.
No.
This is a quote that is being made by experts.
Yeah.
As it's already destroyed more than 110,000 acres. It swept through Redding, California, a city of 100,000 people. It's knocked down, I think, well over 500 structures, if not, no, excuse me, 880 homes.
Yeah. And again, not to be grim, but to sort of go back to the point of how terrible this fire truly is, that was at the time of printing of the story that you're reading. I don't know where it stands of now. And this is something, you know, but I mean, we as men and women that try to, you know, pay the respect to the people that we need to pay respect to, we always seem to call out, you know, military personnel and say thank you for your service. The next time you see a firefighter, you know, say the same thing, because especially in this state of California, you know, these men and women put themselves in harm's way every single year. I mean, there's never a year where there isn't some sort of wildfire that needs to be fought on multiple fronts in this state. And, you know, we've seen it, you know, a lot this last week. Too many reminders that, you know, being a firefighter is not the safest job in the world. While it's not necessarily, you know, heralded as the same as a police officer who goes out there and, you know, arrests bad guys, they're still putting themselves in harm's way, not only in front of fires, but, you know, in front of, you know, troubled individuals. And they're just trying to help. And, you know, these men and women could have taken a much easier, cushy job, but instead they tried to protect us all, and some ultimately pay the ultimate sacrifice. And we appreciate them very much.
Absolutely. And I I've talked about this before on my show, on our show, is the fact that growing up in Malibu since 1972, I've been through every horrific fire out there. And I bow to firemen and I bow to firewomen every time I see them, mentally, truly.
Yeah.
They are studs and studstresses and just incredible, incredible. More power to, and also my heart and condolences go out to the fireman who lost his life in the fire. He was setting a backfire, TJ, and a tree fell on him.
Mm.
Oh, God, so tragic.
I mean, that's the thing. You think that they just have to worry about the fire itself, and it's just not the case. There are so many other factors that are related to the fire. It's not just the flames you have to worry about. It's that debris. It's the lack of oxygen. It's the sheer heat. I mean, it doesn't help, Bruce. Like, obviously, they're fighting a fire that is, you know, I don't even know what the temperatures are, but the air temperature here, I mean, it's the hottest part of the summer, it feels like.
Yep. It's tough all the way around. There are people out there that are trying to entertain them. I think it was Neil Young that went out and gave a concert, you know, with his guitar, if I'm not mistaken. Chef, now tell me if I'm saying his name right. He's a big UFC fan. Celebrity chef Guy Fieri.
Guy Fieri.
Fieri. F-I-E-R.
Correct. Oh, yeah. It doesn't look like it, but yeah, Guy Fieri.
Well, I'm giving Guy tremendous credit. I've met Guy numerous times at the UFC. He's invited me to go to his restaurants. He's the nicest guy in the world.
Great restaurants, too. There's one, I think, at Planet Hollywood, the Planet Hollywood casino on the strip there. Just amazing chef.
Well, here's how he stepped up. With thousands displaced by devastating wildfires, right, he headed up to Redding, California with his son to serve up meals for hundreds of victims and rescue workers over the weekend. So with friends and volunteers, they loaded up their cars with food, drove 4 hours north from California's wine country to Shasta County, where the fires are. That's where two fast-moving fires have killed four people and forced 20,000 people to evacuate their homes there. So on his own ticket, he went up there, did that. That is a true celebrity to me. That is a person who is giving of himself and not just taking. Good for you, Chef. Say it again.
Guy Fieri.
Good for you, Guy Fieri. And I'll get your name. I always call him Guy when I see him. Thank God he doesn't ask me to say Mr. Fieri.
Right, okay. Yeah. He's not that kind of person either. Not a very formal guy. Very laid back. And yeah, his attitude, I think, actually is presented on the plate as well. Just he makes the kind of food that just makes everyone happy and comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd love to have him on the show sometime. Did you have any luck getting that young boy from Minneapolis?
To be honest with you, my wife has been suffering some health issues, and I haven't been able to do the legwork like I wanted to. So, no, we'll,
I hope she's okay.
We'll,
hope she's okay.
Yeah. We're working through it. We'll make something happen hopefully next week. But it's a story that, you know, we read last week, and if people want to go check it out, always a good enough excuse to check out the archive. Go do it. But you know, we'll make it happen. I'm promising you that, Buff.
All right. Sounds good. Now let's get on to some other news. There's some herb news in the mail, and I don't mean Herb Dean.
Right.
Canadian brewers are now experimenting with beer, right?
Right.
And not the kind of beer that's going to get you drunk. They're talking about putting THC content in it. And I don't know if this beer is already out there, but beer that contains THC and can be sold where it's legal.
Right. Yeah. I heard an article or heard a radio show discuss this, and apparently, like, the high from it as well is a lot quicker acting than some of the other edibles that are out there. So if, you know, people do partake, whether it's medicinally or recreationally, wherever, you know, the rules, you know, state wherever you are, this might be a better sort of choice for some people that, you know, I hear a lot of stories, Bruce, about people that have, you know, never really messed around with it. And for the first time, they do an edible and they don't think that it's working. So they go ahead and eat more.
They do more.
And then all of a sudden they're calling the local emergency room because they're going to overdose on marijuana, which is not possible.
Yeah, no, it's not. But it's, you know, it's a scary feeling when you're not used to it, I'm sure, for those individuals that don't do it. So if your choice is to get baked on bitter or stoned on stout, as
right,
I say,
right,
I would just recommend that you have your one bottle.
Baked on bitter, serving. Stoned on stout. I like that. That's good.
That was quick, right?
Yeah.
Very quick. All right. Now we go on. Let's talk about a little more drug action going on, but the most horrid kind possible. A Colombia drug gang.
Mm.
Get this. Colombia narcotics officer Sombra is on the run after one of the most powerful drug cartels put a $70,000 bounty on her head.
Oh, God.
Okay. But here's the thing. Her head is not the head of a female human being. This is a highly decorated German shepherd dog, right?
What?
A highly decorated German shepherd dog. And basically what it is, according to reports, the Urbinos drug gang, which is considered Colombia's most feared criminal organization, they put the hit on Sombra, the German shepherd, who's a six-year-old dog, because he just recently sniffed out 10 tons of cocaine, good for this dog, in two separate busts.
Wow.
Right? So Sombra, which means shadow in English, he's been working Colombia's port cities, right? But officials now, they moved Urbinos up to the Bogota airport because it's outside the Urbinos gang's turf.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like a police officer involved in a shooting is now on desk duty, but it's for her own safety. So this gang is known for taking out hits on its enemies, but usually it's in hundreds of dollars. But now they put 70,000 out. And that's because in 6 years, she has helped bust 245 drug dealing suspects.
Wow.
What a dog. What a dog.
You know,
good for this dog.
You know what is almost more alarming than this entire story is the fact that in it you said that their normal bounty on the heads of individuals is usually in the hundreds of dollars. Like,
mm-hmm.
It concerns me that someone will consider murdering someone for hundreds of dollars. I'm not saying that tens of thousands of dollars make it more acceptable, but for hundreds of dollars, Buff, I'll pay you hundreds of dollars to not kill me. By the way, don't anyone threaten my life. I don't want to pay you hundreds of dollars to not kill me, but you get the point.
Happens all the time, TJ. Happens all the time.
I mean,
sick people out there that do sick things for little money. When you're dealing in a country that is not a country of high level income for all these individuals, I mean, it all spells itself out.
Well,
but $70,000, you know, take care of this dog and then get this dog back there and bust as many of these bad people as you can. I'm all for it. Kudos. As we go talking about animals, there's one thing here. I found this to be weird. This guy goes to the zoo, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is not a joke. I'm not talking about a joke.
All right.
So a zoo is being accused of painting a donkey to look like a zebra.
I heard about this, and apparently it worked, at least for a little while.
It did. An 18-year-old man named Mahmoud Sarhan was visiting a recently opened animal sanctuary. Now, this is in Cairo, Egypt, right, at the International Guard Municipal Park, and he spotted this strange-looking animal. He says, certain things stood out and made it suspicious. The black paint had melted on the donkey's face. The ears didn't look like the right size for a zebra. And then he posted the picture up on his Facebook page, and all of a sudden it all came back.
Yeah.
It was a donkey. They painted it to look like a zebra. Seriously? Seriously?
Well,
I have enough problems with zoos, let alone you've got to, like, falsify an animal. That's
crazy. Also, too, that paint on that animal's skin cannot be good for it. You know
toxic.
What I mean?
Toxic.
Yeah.
Sure it's toxic.
There's some real health concerns there for this animal.
Yeah. Well, that's one said, done, and out. Now, this is one way, and now that I've learned how to say the name of the establishment correctly, but one way to get Chick-fil-A for life, right?
Yeah.
A baby girl was born in a Texas Chick-fil-A, right?
Right.
So now she gets free food from Chick-fil-A for life and a future job, they promise.
What?
Yeah, isn't that pretty incredible? Now, I'm not saying if you're about ready to you know,
well, hey,
to get to that position, run to a Chick-fil-A and lie in the booth. I'm just for free food and a future job.
Right.
But just on this one little scenario.
Right.
So basically they said it was only fitting because they gave birth in the restroom of a San Antonio Chick-fil-A. Okay.
Right.
And in celebration of birth on Tuesday, they said free food for life at her parents' favorite fast food joint and a guaranteed job when she turns 14.
Yeah. I mean,
I find that to be very cool.
Hey, it's a cool sort of publicity stunt. I'm just worried about copycats. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that people are that desperate that they want free Chick-fil-A for life, so they're going to make their, you know, expecting wives, you know, hang out in the restaurant until, you know, something happens, but you never know.
Hey, TJ, if there's somebody out there that's willing to take somebody's life for hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
There's somebody out there that's willing to do something funny to get Chick-fil-A for life.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I've heard about airlines doing this as well. Like, if a woman gives birth on an airplane while in flight, they've given the child, like, you know, one free flight a year or something like that. Like, I think those things are sort of cool, but I would hate to think that it would ever influence someone's behavior, you know, during one of those very serious times when it comes to health concerns.
Well, let's end the show on a really cool note, okay? My congratulations goes out to a young man named William Milas, okay? Mm-hmm. He's achieved his college degree.
Okay.
He wants to be an astrophysicist. He just graduated from St. Petersburg College. He is now the youngest man to ever graduate from St. Petersburg College.
How young?
11 years old. He just graduated college at 11 years old. He graduated high school when he was 9.
What?
Right? He was always on a fast track. By the time he was 2, he was doing simple math, and at 4, he had already learned algebra.
So there's, how?
This is a gifted human being. This is a gifted human being.
Well, I guess. I mean, that's the thing, too. Like, you kind of have to want to be that smart if you're that young and you're sticking with it. I mean, my son is good at a lot of subjects, excellent reader. He's 7 years old, though, and wants to, you know, play video games and run around. So I can't get him to read as much as I would like him to, even though he's so good at it. But, wow, that's insanity. 11 years old, and he has
11 years old.
A bachelor's degree already.
And aspirations to be an astrophysicist. There's one thing I'm going to bet for sure, and I'll bet you $1,000 to a donut.
Uh-huh.
Okay? He doesn't play Fortnite.
Man, I would almost take that bet. Everybody plays Fortnite. Except me.
I don't. He might have played it, but I'm going to tell you right now, this kid with this brain,
he's
not. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with playing.
No. I get what you're saying.
My problem is that's what they do all day, because there's so much to do as a young man, a young child. You and I didn't have video games when we were kids. We were on our bikes playing baseball and doing everything out there.
I mean, I've still got some gravel in my elbows because I was a kid doing those things. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I'm making a light joke, but it's actually half serious.
You know what? I bet you maybe he has played Fortnite, but it was from a different point of view altogether. He's probably trying to figure out, like, certain patterns in the game and how it's programmed and if there's a way to exploit it, etc. I mean, those are the types of ways that, you know, geniuses look at things. And, man, good for him. Good for his parents. I mean, if my kid was on that fast track, like, man, I might quit my job. I might just hang out and be like, look, you're going to be brilliant and make a lot of money. Let's do right by daddy.
You know what really has fulfilled my heart last week and this week on the show is that we talked about two young men, one age 13 last week and one age 11 this week, that are just really prime examples of just doing good.
Right.
Just doing good. Just realizing that there's more in their brain than just the 5% of whatever it is most of us realize. And being an entrepreneur or being a gifted child in education with aspirations and dreams. This, to me, just like as older gentlemen that we are, and my always saying, be a role model to your sphere of influence.
Right.
They're starting this action at a very young age.
Right.
And I think it's fantastic. And I really do.
I mean, you know, there's that old saying, like, the children are all that we have, you know, like, our future is all that we have. And, you know, a lot of things. I mean, you turn on any cable news network, it's all doom and gloom. No matter what side of the aisle you're on, it's all doom and gloom. And stories like these are the ones that get overlooked. I mean, I feel better about our chances as a country if an 11-year-old kid is about to, you know, turn his attention to becoming an astrophysicist. Like, that doesn't happen. And when it does happen, we don't seem to celebrate it. So look at you, too, ending the show on a solid note. It's only taken 10 years for you to figure it out, but I love it.
Hey, listen, it's like poker, 5 minutes to learn and a lifetime to master. I'm always learning. You know that about me. I wake up every day to learn something new, and you can tell me I'm wrong and prove it to me, and I'll turn my opinion around. So I'm going to give you one last quote from this young man.
Yep.
He says, I want to prove to the world that God does exist through science.
Wow.
Big task.
Hey.
And his goal is to complete his doctorate by the time he's 18, which is the age that most people be in college. Good for him. Good for him.
Well, I mean, he's got 7 years to complete his doctorate. So what – I mean, that's almost half his life that he's been around. So I have no doubt in my mind that he'll definitely complete that. But, you know, lofty goals for this young man. And, you know, I support him. I support him wholeheartedly. That's a great story.
I do totally. You know what's also really nice, and I don't mean anything bad by this, is that he – this is a young man born and raised in the United States of America.
Right.
We're not talking about a foreign country. We're talking about our country. Yeah. I love that. I mean, not that I wouldn't talk about it if it was foreign. I just realized I love this. I love this.
We hear a lot of things about that, Bruce. We hear a lot of things about these young geniuses. And I mean, you know, to a certain extent, we just brought up how children are different in other countries when we were talking about the Thai soccer team that was, you know, in the caves. And it's difficult to sort of accept the fact that, you know, young Americans are not as vigilant and hardworking generally as maybe some of the other countries where the beginnings are a bit more humble, if you will. And, you know, and again, too, we may have the perception completely wrong. It's just we can only consume what is presented to us through the various media outlets that we look at. And again, these stories, I mean, you don't usually have a story like this leading national news.
I'm with you all the way. Boy, it's so nice to have a show where I agree with everything being said by my guest, by my co-host.
Hey, you know, well, like minds, you know, we do well together sometimes.
Absolutely. And I just got a text from my beloved Kristen that I have 6 videos to film, that I have to be in a tuxedo and ready to go in the studio in 24 minutes. So I'm going to have to sign up on the show.
You better hustle, Buff.
Well, since the Stipe Miocic and Ryan Miocic birth announcement that I made for them.
Yeah.
Which I just sent them privately.
Mm-hmm.
Then they put it out on Instagram, and I got all the Fuhrer that I got. Oh, my God. We've been inundated with orders for babies. So many babies being born and the birthdays and the weddings and all. Again, and I have to say, for what it's worth, July 2018, biggest month in voiceovers coming through BruceBuffer.com ever.
That is awesome, ever. Buff. Fist bump on that. But by the way, the fist bump with the fighters, man, that's the only thing that's maybe more powerful or more popular than these voiceover requests. My goodness, everyone's trying to get a piece of the Buff.
Well, you know, remember, I'm not the one that instigates that.
I don't know who originally did it, but I know that Cole Miller claimed to be the first one and felt like everyone was infringing on his special thing. But you're not going to leave a man or woman hanging like that.
I would never disrespect a male or female warrior in my beloved Octagon ever. Yeah. I give them every ounce of everything I have when I introduce them.
Yeah.
And if that's what they want, that's what they get. Because they are the ones putting their blood, sweat, and tears on the line, my friend, not me. They're doing it.
We'll give a hat tip, though, to Mr. Miller for being an innovator.
No, yes, he is. You know, along with Dan. You know,
Of course. Well, Dan Hardy likes to scream at you. Now Dillashaw does the same thing. You know, everybody's got their sort of own little thing that they do with you when you introduce them. And, you know, as a viewer who's sitting on, you know, this side of the screen, I love seeing it come out.
Well, you're going to see it Saturday night with that lineup for sure. I'll promise you that.
Oh, my goodness.
TJ, anything coming up you want to tell the audience?
You know, nothing really. Just hanging out, you know, digesting all the things that are mixed martial arts and its current events. I would appreciate if people would check out my platform to do so. It's patreon.com/betweenrounds. You can catch me on shirtod.com and always follow me on Twitter at TJ DeSantis.
Fantastic. And those of you that follow me on Instagram, it's at Bruce Buffer UFC. On Twitter, it's at Bruce Buffer. And at Facebook, there's like 3 different pages, so take your choice. But at any rate, thank you for tuning in. Really looking forward to Saturday. We'll see you from the Octagon. I will see you from the Octagon at UFC 227 Saturday night. Heck of a night of action. Better be, because we just came off an incredible night of action in Calgary. With that being said, everybody, be a role model to your sphere of influence. Treat everybody around you with respect the way that you want to be treated. Set your goals. Write them down. Do your research. Learn about everything you're setting out to do, so when you step on that path, you can be the best you can be. And that's what it takes to win. And that's what we talk about on It's Time Radio. It's all about winning. So it's time to win. Have a great week. And I'll see you next week. I'll talk to you next week. And with that being said, Buffer out.
The following podcast is a TJ DeSantis production. Comments, questions, and inquiries can be sent to DeSantisProd@gmail.com.